This is a National Museum of Australia recording. For more information, visit nma.gov.au/audio.
Good afternoon, everybody. Welcome to the National Museum. Those of you who aren't from the National Museum, and I see we have some people from the Museum of Australian Democracy, and I think the Australian War Memorial as well. Yes, welcome to what's essentially one of our staff seminars, but because Jim is a person of such standing and has such an interesting topic to address us about today, we threw the invitation open to other institutions. So welcome to you all. Jim's been a great friend of the National Museum of Australia and has really helped forge links with the National Museum of American History at the Smithsonian, where he's been a senior scholar for many years. He's also developing a relationship with the National Portrait Gallery in the Smithsonian, so he'll become a kind of dual institutional senior scholar sometime soon. He holds a BA with honours in history from Rhodes College and an MA and PhD in history from the Vanderbilt University, and he previously served as Associate Director for Curatorial Affairs at the National Museum of American History. To say he's a mover and shaker in the world of public history is underestimating completely his role. Prior to joining the National Museum of American History, he served as Deputy Executive Director of the American Historical Association and as Director of Education and Special Programs for the American Association for State and Local History. His professional activities have included service as President of the National Council on Public History, President of the Society for History in the Federal Government, Chair of the Nominating Board of the Organisation of American Historians, and as a member of the Board of Editors for the journal The Public Historian. He currently serves on the American Association for State and Local History Council, and as chair of the Smithsonian's Ethics Advisory Board. He has numerous publications, the American Association of Museums Guide to Collections Planning, published in 2004, Public History, Essays from the Field, revised edition appeared in 2004, and Ordinary People in Everyday Life, Perspectives on the New Social History, published back in 1983. He's also got essays in some forthcoming publications, The Routledge Companion to Museum Ethics, Redefining Ethics for the 21st Century Museum, and Grassroot Memorials, The Politics of Memorialising Traumatic Death. I think I'll stop there. You've got the general idea. He's been involved in public history for a very long time and has very interesting perspectives to bring to us today, particularly around museums, memorials and history, collecting and interpreting September the 11th. So please welcome Jim.
Thank you, Louise. Matt and I were just talking before, just a few moments ago. We sort of worked out that I would do this talk today without, admittedly, the one of us thinking that it's 2 days after the 9th anniversary of September 11. So I won't claim that we were really thinking through this, but it is a timely subject, I think. And I would be happy to discuss after my paper about specific challenges that we're facing for the 10th anniversary of next year. What I'm going to do is really talk about work that I've been involved in regarding memorialization. I've been involved in this work for nearly a decade. While my work centers on September 11, it intersects with a larger discussion about memorializing traumatic death, variously described as spontaneous memorials, makeshift memorials, and grassroots memorials, essentially unofficial and non-institutional memorials, although I'll challenge that assumption a bit shortly. A version of the ideas that I'm going to share with you will be part of an anthology that Louise mentioned that will be published by Bergon Press later this year. The anthology was built around a series of papers that a group of us gave at a meeting of the European Association of Cultural Anthropologists a few years ago. I'm one of the few, if maybe the only historian involved, and that my involvement is because of other connections with scholars working on the Madrid bombings later, that came later. The volume is indeed very broad in scope. Not only it includes not only my essay and a few others on September 11, but also essays on traffic accidents, floods, the murder of a gay politician, and other moments that have engaged public mourning. While others in the book are focusing on the politics and performance of grief, my interest is in the role of museums in the documentation, preservation, and interpretation of such traumatic moments, and more specifically, the tension between public memorialization and the roles of museums, between memorializing a moment and collecting and interpreting it. The September 11 began for staff of the Museum of American History with a routine staff meeting, but things quickly changed as word spread through the auditorium of terrorist attacks on the World Trade Center and the Pentagon, threats to the nation's capital, a car bomb at the U.S. Department of State, fires on the National Mall, airplanes circling over the museum, and chaos on the streets. Fortunately, most of that was simply rumor, but the realities we shortly learned of were horrifying enough. Uncertain what would happen next, we kept the museum closed, set up a command center, pulled out our disaster plan, and sent staff home. We managed to get through that day, returning to resume our work in the days that followed. But much had changed and would change over the coming months. The museum itself was a different place. We soon had temporary concrete barriers ringing the building. We had bag checks at the entrances, not only for visitors but for museum staff, and quite a bit of uncertainty about what would happen next. Our behavior changed as well. We suddenly became more aware of sirens in the distance that we would have ignored before. We stole looks out the windows during meetings to see if the surveillance planes were still circling over. And many of the staff brought in radios and flashlights and discussed evacuation plans with family and friends. And then came the anthrax scare, increasing the sense of a city under siege. Nine years later, the temporary barriers are just now being replaced by a permanent perimeter security system. Magnetometers now supplement bag checks, and the museum's mail continues to be irradiated for anthrax 9 years later. There has not been a return to normal. But even as things changed, one thing has remained the same: the museum's commitment to collecting and interpreting history. That did not, however, mean simply business as usual. The tragic events of September 11 reshaped our agenda, posing new challenges as we entered uncharted territory. As staff began returning to work in the days that followed the terrorist attacks, hallway discussion quickly turned to what September 11 would mean for the museum and the larger community in which we work. What role should museums play in a time of crisis? What public expectations would we encounter? What new responsibilities would we have? What role should we play in constructing collective memory? And perhaps most importantly, how would we address our responsibilities as museums Within that tragic context, at the difficult intersection of grief and history. Collecting is at the foundation of all that museums do, and so it was only natural that discussion focused on collecting almost immediately. On September 13th, 9 years ago today, the Museum's Collections Committee changed the topic of an already scheduled conversation on collecting in order to address the issues and concerns that were being raised within the museum about collecting, about responding to September 11. The most basic question was simply, should we collect? Despite being known as the nation's addict, the Smithsonian cannot collect everything and does not collect everything. As is the case with most, if not all, history museums, the Museum of American History does not collect systematically and has built not an encyclopedic or comprehensive collection, but rather one that is selective and representative. As you know, collecting for history museums is more of an art than a science. Our collections are shaped by curators' perspectives and expertise rather than any hard and fast plans or rules. It is never a given that the Museum of American History will collect in a specific area or in any topic. Whether to collect is a judgment call made by knowledgeable and experienced curators. But September 11 did not feel like a routine collecting opportunity that we could just elect to pursue or not pursue. It clearly constituted an important moment in the life of the nation. While some staff argued that the museum should move cautiously to avoid appearing opportunistic or gallish in a time of national mourning, most recognized that the public would expect us to collect. More importantly, if we didn't collect, we understood that we would have to be prepared to explain why. Indeed, the public demonstrated that they cared deeply about this through emails, calls, and letters to curators suggesting and even offering items for the museum to collect. And then in December 2001, just a few months later, the United States Congress weighed in as well, officially charging the Museum of American History to collect and preserve artifacts relating to the September 11 attacks. So ultimately, the Museum of American History is the steward of the nation's memory. We are obligated to collect. But then there's the issue of, even if we acknowledge that we're going to collect, what about September 11 should the museum collect? Now, we had our standard answer to that question. Our collecting centers on objects and that tell stories, that evoke moments in lives. And our priorities regarding September 11 were clear, we thought. Compelling objects with compelling stories that reflect the diverse experiences and perspectives of that day. That agenda meant collecting not just objects that tell the stories of death, survival, response, and rescue, but also ephemeral materials that reflect the outpouring of grief not only on that day, but in the weeks and months that followed. There were obvious precedents for that kind of collecting, for collecting the ephemera of loss. The collecting of such material at the Vietnam Veterans Memorial beginning in the early 1980s, the collection developed at the Oklahoma City National Memorial and Museum following the 1995 bombing in that city, and more recently the collecting led by the Littleton Museum after the Columbine shootings in 1999. While very different circumstances gave rise to each, note that many of these were about domestic terrorism, not about international terrorism. All three collections are overwhelmed with stuffed animals, cards and poems, prayers and religious objects, flags, and a wide range of personal mementos both spontaneous and intentional, that dramatically reflect the public sense of anger and loss. And all three have faced enormous challenges in dealing with the sheer volume of materials for which they have found themselves responsible. But the Museum of American History was facing what I would argue is a fundamentally different situation. While in each of those cases, the Vietnam Wall, Oklahoma City, and Columbine, while in each of those cases, collecting was an outgrowth of stewardship for a very specific memorial site, the collecting imperative for the Museum of American History in regard to September 11 was fundamentally different. It was quite simply focused on developing a standalone museum collection that would represent all three crash sites, documenting the events of the day and their aftermath. The museum's responsibility was not to one memorial site, but rather to the national memory, and that meant a different approach to collecting. Without the day-to-day responsibilities for memorial site that our predecessors faced, the museum arguably did not face the same sense of urgency. We did not have to rush to rescue materials left in our care. And as historians and curators, we value scholarly distance and perspective. And a cautious approach to collecting, divorced from the politics of the moment, held much attraction for many of the curators in American history. But when should we collect? When would be the right time? Could we actually wait and develop some distance from that moment? Or was it instead our responsibility to move in quickly? To be honest, I found arguments at the museum for historical distance rather disingenuous, since the museum had long engaged in contemporary collecting. For example, every 4 years, the museum sends curators to collect from presidential primaries and the national political conventions. I want to make clear that the debate among curators over timing did not reflect concerns about becoming entwined in a difficult political debate. Indeed, at that moment, the nation seemed more unified than ever, with little attention paid to the relatively small number of dissenters or critics. Instead, curators' reluctance, I believe, masked a deeper concern, a real reticence to face the raw emotions of the moment, a prospect that was outside the comfort zone of curators who were, quite frankly, more at home in the world of scholarly detachment. Fulfilling the museum's September 11 collecting responsibilities would mean dealing with those still grieving, those still in shock or traumatized. But in the final analysis, avoidance was not an option, particularly when it came to documenting public grief and memorialization. Curators had to move more quickly than in any collecting area to do that. The most compelling makeshift memorials were out of doors and quickly began falling prey to the weather. But what are the ethics of collecting memorials and the ephemera of loss? The museum field expects curators to collect with sensitivity and respect, but offers little guidance beyond that for such collecting moments. In acquiring materials from the September 11 crash sites, curators faced unique challenges, juggling the needs and wishes of victims' families and friends with the requirements of official investigations, while wrestling with more sensitive issues such as the almost certain presence of traces of human remains on the objects being collected, as well as contaminants such as asbestos. Collecting the ephemera of loss presented a very different but no less challenging set of issues. And I'm making a distinction here between the crash sites and the memorial materials. We normally acquire objects from known donors rather than in the field. And we're wary about collecting materials left in spontaneous memorials. Would our urgency in collecting such materials be seen as callous and self-serving? as declaring an end to grief. At a moment when people still hoped their loved ones might be found alive, would museums appear to be telling them that it was over and they should move on? Moreover, collecting these materials and storing them in museums, that is, removing them from public view, would negate the very purpose of the materials, the reasons they were created and left. Should museums remove memorial materials from public view, even if the intention is to save them from the weather? As I said earlier, the National Park Service had certainly answered that question affirmatively decades before. Every evening, systematically removing and preserving materials left at the Vietnam Wall. And that precedent had been invoked in collecting materials in Oklahoma City. But Arnold Lehman, director of the Brooklyn Museum of Art, argued that such collecting violated the very imperative of memorialization. He argued, "These posters and great collections of flowers and candles are the real thing. This is made up of tears. What happens if, figuratively speaking, you put a box of plexiglass over it?" Indeed, when the New York City Department of Parks and Recreation began clearing memorial materials at Union Square when rain threatened, the public reacted with alarm. How can a museum dare to claim ownership of such very personal, although public, expressions of grief and loss? Years later, David Shate, a curator at the Museum of American History, reflecting back on his experience, articulated much the same sentiment. He said, "I felt it would be an act of desecration to collect something off a living memorial." But walking away and allowing the shrines to degrade was not ethically responsible, for it would mean the loss of materials that are in the public interest to preserve. Nor was it quite simply, nor was walking away a viable solution. Although the public complained if the outdoor materials were removed, they also complained if they were allowed to deteriorate. Anthropologist Sylvia Grider puts it simply, "Spontaneous memorials lose their emotional impact and symbolic integrity when they become soggy, windblown, and tattered." The memorials were not only places of pilgrimage, but evidence of our collective grief. And the public made clear in conversations on site and in phone calls and emails that they could not bear to see them degrade as though of no meaning or value. While makeshift in origin, the memorials had become icons of shared loss, and preserving them became inextricably tied up in preserving the memory that day. Museums operate in the public trust, and the public expected us to act accordingly. It was obvious that whatever the course of action, there would be critics, not for political reasons, but for emotional ones. To use a colloquialism, there was a sense within the museum community of damned if you do and damned if you don't. There was no easy answer. In the final analysis, we needed to collect, but had to do so with more sensitivity to emotions than we're accustomed to. That meant, for example, sometimes quelling entrepreneurial collecting impulses, and we have very active entrepreneurs in the curatorial ranks at the museum. We had to tamp down those impulses and wait for materials to be offered. But beyond the ethical and emotional issues, how much of that material could we realistically collect? The magnitude of memorials was overwhelming. Within days, New York City, the crash site of Flight 93 in Pennsylvania, and the Pentagon were inundated with spontaneous or makeshift memorials. The material was deeply felt and often highly evocative, but it could literally be measured by the ton. As you know, for museums, the prospect of collecting that material would be overwhelming. Over the course of two decades, the National Park Service's collection from the Vietnam Veterans Memorial had grown to around 90,000 items. But the volume of September 11 materials from New York alone was clearly exponentially greater than that. The Oklahoma City National Memorial Museum had tried to follow the Park Service's precedent and soon found themselves managing a collection that was growing dramatically at significant cost resources, but with little additional interpretive or exhibition value. While some scholars might have preferred that they save everything, they basically didn't have the resources to do that and still fulfill their public roles. They have since established parameters or criteria for how long memorial materials will be left at specific locations and what kinds of materials will be collected, which directed to outreach and which destroyed. Even with those guidelines in place, the museum still has collected, the Oklahoma City Museum, still has collected over 68,000 memorial items. The harsh reality is that few history museums today have the resources to maintain systematic research collections. Instead, our priorities are representative objects for exhibition, and there are only so many teddy bears and t-shirts you need for that purpose. Moreover, the Museum of American History, the Museum of the City of New York, New York Historical Society, New York State Museum, and the others engaged in documenting September 11 had to consider how to process and house the materials we collected. Memorials are complex composite objects consisting of textiles, candles, organic materials, synthetics, paper, tape, other materials. And the unstable nature of those materials pose significant and potentially costly conservation challenges. The structural and varied material instabilities of the memorials presented a particularly perplexing situation. From a conservation standpoint, the prudent course of action would be to dismantle or disaggregate the memorials and address the varied preservation needs of the different materials that comprise them. But if the power of the memorials is in the assemblage of the materials, wouldn't such action, however well-intentioned, be destructive? Is it indeed more important to preserve the look of the memorial rather than the individual pieces that make it up? Is it enough to photograph memorials and create documentary records, as did the New York Historical Society and the Library of Congress, or must we preserve the actual memorials in their entirety, as did the Museum of the City of New York, which collected the 170-foot-long construction fence at the Bellevue Hospital that was covered with flyers, photographs, and other materials after September 11 and became known as the Bellevue Wall of Prayers. And as such issues were being discussed, conservators, curators, and all having these discussions, the clock was ticking. The longer the exposure to weather, the more likely such objects would be to mold, potentially spreading contaminants into the museum's other collections and threatening the health of its staff. Museums always have to balance the cost of taking responsibility for objects offered to their collections with the benefit of preserving them. And in this case, the potential cost of preserving could be considerable. Intended to be evocative rather than systematic, the museum collections that were assembled by the various museums convey the complex idiosyncratic nature of the makeshift memorials and of the memorialization process. Initially, the photos and messages people were posting were intended not as memorials, but as part of the search for the missing. Over 90,000 such missing flyers were posted across New York City alone. But in too short a time, The missing became the lost, and missing flyers became the core of more complex makeshift memorials, consisting of jumbles of objects that reflected the outpouring of public grief. While the Museum of American History did not collect entire memorial installations, others did. For us, the issue was not whether it was appropriate or not to collect the materials, the memorials, but where to best focus our collecting efforts. And we believed that our sister museums in New York, for example, were better positioned to take on that agenda. The memorials were indeed site-specific, rooted in place, and hence the best fit was with state and local rather than national institutions. As I said, the Museum of the City of New York collected the Bellevue Wall of Prayers. The New York State Museum collected three fence sections from Liberty Plaza, as well as makeshift memorials at St. Paul's Chapel, the New York City Fire Department, and elsewhere. The State Museum also collected the platform on Manhattan's Fulton Street, where people went to view Ground Zero. This was constructed in response to September 11. The utilitarian platform itself became the site of a makeshift memorial. But all such memorials were not in public. That seems to be out of... Okay. We collected... Let me see. Well, I'll just go on. We collected, for example, from a memorial set up in a trailer by the New York Port Authority Police Department to honor fallen comrades. While it was a spontaneous expression of grief, the memorial was actually institutional in context. It was set up by the Port Authority. The museum was not collecting at that moment materials left on the sidewalk. The museum's curator did not take the materials from the Port Authority, did not take memorial materials or even ask for them. He collected from the Port Authority memorial only when they were offered in the context of September 11. Many otherwise entrepreneurial curators, and I will tell you the person doing that collecting was among the most entrepreneurial that we had. Many otherwise entrepreneurial curators demonstrated heightened ethical sensitivity. As those memorial materials became museum objects, they ceased to be what they were, instead becoming part of our institutionalized memories, isolated in the dynamic in which they were created. A particularly striking case of transformation and meaning was the Chelsea Jeans Memorial. The owner of the Chelsea Jeans store on Lower Broadway in Manhattan created his own memorial by walling off a 50-foot square portion of his shop as it was on September 11, creating essentially a time capsule of ash-covered shelves of jeans, T-shirts, and tank tops bearing American flag logos. The owner stated simply, "I wanted to preserve it just as it was to freeze this moment in history." His memorial in his store became a popular pilgrimage site for visitors to Ground Zero. And then in 2002, the New York Historical Society acquired the memorial, hazardous materials and all, and commissioned a custom-designed sealed exhibition case that would allow the public to contemplate the memorial without direct exposure to its contents. Covering it with the box of plexiglass feared by Arnold Lehman arguably heightened its power, conferring on it the status of museum object while dramatically drawing visitor attention to what the Historical Society termed hazardous yet emotionally charged dust. And this is actually the Port Authority material that we, this is a view of the Port Authority Memorial and then of one of the objects we collected. while there was much attention to the spontaneous memorial materials, museums also collected what might be more accurately described as intentional memorial materials. While not spontaneously created, these memorials were still grassroots in origin and rooted in ritual. For example, the Museum of American History collected this scrapbook created by an artist and poet from Mobile, Alabama. Much like a spontaneous memorial, the scrapbook is a powerful personal expression that includes objects and original poetry, along with pictures and newspaper clippings. The choice of format, Cheever used an old account book, conveys the layered nature of history, the present overlaid on the past. Indeed, much like spontaneous memorials, the scrapbook is an assemblage, albeit from a single perspective. An example of collective rather than individual expression is a community remembrance book collected by the museum from the city of Mountain View, California. The over 300 messages from local residents and drawings by area children were an outpouring of grief from a community that did not have, was not directly impacted by the terrorist attacks, but was nonetheless grieving. While not part of a spontaneous shrine, this condolence book is arguably part of the same dynamic, a communal opportunity for creative expression of grief, spontaneous on the part of the individuals, even if intentional on the part of the community. In other words, the dynamic between the spontaneous memorials played out in very different ways. The dynamic behind the memorials played out in very different ways for different people in different locations. And it was important to document and collect those less dramatic and public expressions as well. But even if museums have the resources to collect all these kinds of materials, should they? What exactly do memorial materials and the ephemera of loss tell us about history? Certainly, they are important as evidence of grief and mourning, an important part of the moment, which connects us to larger issues of how society mourns and copes with tragedy. But how much do we actually need to tell that particular story among all the stories of September 11? As emotionally evocative as the missing persons posters, spontaneous memorials, and commemorative art might be, they do not tell us all the stories that we need to tell. Such objects were created to express grief and indeed are emotionally compelling, but other less dramatic objects often better tell the story of September 11. Sometimes the most seemingly ordinary or unremarkable objects are the ones that speak most eloquently about the human experience of tragedy. Thus, Museum of American History collected some memorial materials, but we also collected objects that told stories of ordinary people in extraordinary circumstances. The squeegee of window washer Jan Dimsher that was the key to the escape of a group of men from the World Trade Center elevator. The shoes that Cecilia Benavente took off as she escaped from the 103rd floor of the World Trade Center. Or Navy Lieutenant Commander David Tarantino's name tag, torn off his shirt by a man he had just met who wanted to be able to tell about Tarantino's heroic acts in rescuing survivors at the Pentagon. The name tag was actually given to the museum by the other man. The other man expected Tarantino to die as he tried to rescue other people. In collecting such objects, the Museum of American History did what museums do on a routine basis. We made choices about what to collect, judgment calls that may sometimes appear idiosyncratic, but are always grounded in curatorial knowledge and expertise. We had to take care in this situation not to let emotions overrule that judgment. Museum collecting is for the long term, not for the moment, and we had to be prepared to live with and care for what we collected long after the moment had passed. Now, memorial materials, collecting memorial materials is, I would argue, a form of field collecting, and it was important, but the way in which the materials, Demscher, Benavente, those materials were retrieved was very different. The memorial materials were retrieved often in bulk, and it distanced the museums that were involved in that somewhat from the grief that it represented. When we were collecting materials from the victims' families or survivors, it was very different for us. More traditional collecting, the transaction between the museum and a known donor, just plays out as it will. In this particular context, however, grief and memorialization changed that relationship, and indeed, I would argue, is key to understanding the collecting process or relationship after September 11th. The collecting transaction between victims, families, and friends and the museum, between victims, families, and friends and the museum, respectively the gift and the receipt of an object, reflected a different dynamic from field collecting, uniquely grounded in the interplay between grief, memory, and history. Giving objects to September 11 collections, such as at the museums, was itself an expression of grief and an act of memorialization by the individuals and institutions who did so. The act of giving was a way of memorializing the individual and the day, of ensuring that those stories would not be forgotten. As such, donating to the museum became part of what Ed Lindenthal describes as active grief, moving beyond private, intimate, passive grief to take action to preserve the memory of a moment and its consequences. While not as spontaneous an expression as the shrines, such donations were nevertheless self-directed and intensely personal, unlike official memorials. The need on the part of many people to express their grief in this way created collecting opportunities for curators. Instead of holding onto objects for their individual needs, people offered them to museums, they offered them to public memory. But that active grief also made the work of curators more difficult. They more often had to say no thank you to individuals struggling to address their grief and preserve their memories through gifts to museums. We could not collect everything, no matter the reason for the offer. And this was enormously stressful for the curators. They spent most of their days saying no rather than yes because of the level of offers. After we met a certain milestone in our involvement in September 11. We had a lunch in which the director asked us to talk about our experiences. And some of the curators broke down in tears talking about what it had been like for them. And these were people who were often working outside any area of expertise they had. The curator who collected at the Pentagon and collected through the mortuary unit at the Pentagon is actually a specialist in domestic life, the home. But he knew how to collect, he knew how to make decisions, and he moved in that direction. Similarly, when museums collected such objects, they were also arguably participating in the act of memorialization. not simply being neutral collecting institutions going about their business. In choosing objects and bringing them into our museum's collections, we infuse them with power. Consider, for example, this object. It's a firefighter's pry bar. Used to pry open things, and it was collected by the Museum of American History. It is a standard firefighter's tool, and it had been owned by New York Fire Department Lieutenant Kevin Pfeiffer. Pfeiffer was killed in the World Trade Center collapse, and the pry bar was given to the museum in his memory by his brother. His brother was Fire Department Battalion Chief Joseph Pfeiffer, and Chief Pfeiffer was in charge at World Trade Center and had sent his brother into the World Trade Center on September 11 and never saw him again. The pry bar is all that Chief Pfeiffer, all they were able to identify. In deciding to collect this object, the museum conferred on it special status. This ordinary object, one that every firefighter on the scene had, this ordinary object was transformed into one of the objects of September 11, part of the nation's collection and part of the official memory that day. Lieutenant Pfeiffer's story took on a level of meaning it would not otherwise have had. It ceased to be a private story of loss and became part of the public narrative, indeed part of our collective memory. Tied up in the this concept of memorialization is what I call relics. Objects that may provide immediate, tangible, intimate connections to the past, but do not constitute historical evidence or proof. Such objects often are no more than touchstones or keepsakes. They evoke the feelings of the moment, but do not help us understand what happened. In the context of September 11, ordinary objects or fragments, such as pieces of twisted steel from the World Trade Center, and airplane fragments. These became objects of extraordinary emotional, if not religious, importance. In taking these objects into our collections, we performed an active role in our collective grief, declaring them icons of our shared loss, concrete testimony to that day and its impact. While the stories of September 11 are far more complicated than can be conveyed with a piece of steel or a fragment of architecture or an airplane fragment, such objects were immensely important to the public, constituting memorials, from their perspective, constituting memorials to those who died that day. Museums also participated more directly and consciously in public memorialization. The Museum of the City of New York created a virtual Union Square, an online version of the spontaneous memorials cropping up around the city. Visitors to the Museum of the City of New York website were invited to contribute artwork, photographs or remembrances as they were doing at locations around the city at the same time. The Museum of American History partnered with George Mason's Center for History and New Media and the American Social History Project at the City University of New York Graduate Center to collect September 11 stories through the web. Individuals have left over 12,500 stories about what they did, saw, or heard on September 11. Some long and detailed, but others simple statements of loss or anger. The resultant September 11 digital archive became a form of online memorial, a place to remember and reflect, to share the stories and images that constitute the memory of that day. It also became a vehicle for preserving some of what I'll tell you about in a moment. The Museum of American History hoped that the development of this web-based archive would take off some of the pressure to memorialize September 11th, a function we were not entirely comfortable with. Well aware of the tension between memory and history, between memorialization and historical interpretation, the museum saw the digital archive as a vehicle for sharing space, for sharing voice, a virtual space for memory. Well, okay, I'm heading into the last section here. Museums played an important role in the museum's and the public's transition from active grief to memory to history in the months that followed the terrorist attacks. In the immediate aftermath, spontaneous shrines functioned as pilgrimage sites, providing places at which we could attempt to come to grips with events which numb our emotions and defy explanations. Sylvia Greider has written that shrines reduce the overwhelming enormity of a catastrophe to a more manageable scale, thus helping to make the event more comprehensible. I'll explain what that is in a minute. As the days stretched into weeks and months and the temporary shrines were dismantled, museums faced pressure to step in and fill that need for a sacred space. Some museums embraced that role as part of their mission as cultural institutions, arguing that museums could play an important role in civic healing. Others, such as the Museum of American History, emphasized repeatedly that museums and memorials serve fundamentally different purposes. We argued that the function of museums is to provide historical meaning or understanding, but that the role of memorials is only to evoke emotion and inspire memory, with messages that are very selective and lack the complexity or nuance that are at the heart of good history. This perspective, memorials and museums as separate functions, is institutionalized, for example, in the establishment of the sixth-floor museum at Dealey Plaza that is separate from the John F. Kennedy Memorial Plaza, and the development, and this is what the images are of, the development of the Oklahoma City National Memorial and Museum. The museum is inside, the memorial is outside. The empty chairs, the survivor tree are memorial, are the memorial part of the site. The September 11 National Memorial and Museum will similarly consist of two very distinct spaces, one for memorialization and one for the museum. In the immediate aftermath of the attacks, a number of museums in New York invited the public to write in memory books, light candles, draw pictures. In other words, to express their grief within the museum walls as they were doing elsewhere around the city. The New York State Museum decided to embrace that role more formally, erecting in a gallery that November two silhouettes of the twin towers of the World Trade Center, composed of small bronze squares representing individuals who had died there. Naming it the World Trade Center Memorial, the museum explicitly adopted a memorial role. But others stopped short of that role and only exhibited memorial material. Rather than becoming memorials, they exhibited memorial material, proposing that exhibiting such materials was a more appropriate healing role for museums, that the materials would provide a context for people to reflect and remember. The New York Fire Museum created a changing exhibit of memorial materials. The Mesoamerica Foundation developed a traveling exhibition of missing flyers entitled Missing, Last Seen at the World Trade Center on September 11, 2001. And City Lore organized another exhibition entitled Missing, which was photographs of the memorials. Museum of American History tried to avoid any involvement in memorialization, arguing that what museums do is provide perspective and context. This is while we're collecting memorial materials, we're trying not to become a memorial ourselves. We did not really want to become a vehicle for expressions of grief or condolence. But we quickly learned that the public did not understand or share that that perspective, that distinction. They did not see the difference between a memorial and museum. And indeed, we received proposal after proposal for memorials to take portions of the World Trade Center or a smash fire truck and establish a place at the museum where Americans could honor those who had lost their lives. As the first anniversary loomed, this is in 2002, that discussion became more than theoretical. How would the Museum of American History mark the one-year anniversary? Should the museum's goal be simply to provide a place to remember and reflect, or should it try to do more, to interpret the events of September 11? Could we bring historical perspective to this event only 1 year later, or should we even try? What would be the appropriate role for the museum? Well, we spent quite a bit of time working through those questions and debating what we should do, and concluded that although we did not feel that we had the distance or perspective to explain the events of September 11, we could provide a place for Americans to come together to mark that anniversary, a place to remember and reflect. We had, for example, Ed Lindenthal, who's written on Oklahoma City National Memorial, on Pearl Harbor, on other sites of the Holocaust Museum. We had him come in. We talked to him. What should we do? What do you think is the right role for us? And we concluded that we should indeed serve a memorial function, despite our initial misgivings. We also recognized that at that moment, that was, quite frankly, the only politically feasible response. Few people would welcome a careful explanation of why September 11 happened. The time was simply not right. What we could and should do, we concluded, is provide a place for the public, for public commemoration, memorialization, acknowledge the many voices, stories, perspectives of that day, and give visitors opportunities to contribute, not simply observe. In other words, we could provide a sacred space, a place for civic healing. On September 11, 2002, we opened the exhibit September 11, Bearing Witness to History. In developing the exhibit, the museum looked to the work of colleagues at not only the Oklahoma City National Memorial and Museum, but also the National Civil Rights Museum in Memphis and the Holocaust Memorial Museum in Washington, D.C., each of which have demonstrated that the emotional impact for the visitor of being physically constructed with the raw material of history, of being asked to remember and reflect, can be a powerful step in the process of questioning and understanding broader historical issues. Arguably, the look and feel of the museum was more memorial than museum. The design was spare, with the objects spaced apart for emotional impact. It was an open, quiet space for contemplation and reflection. The museum worked with grief counselors in developing the exhibit. It was designed so that you could always see your way out, so that you could always make choices about what to see. The museum did not attempt to tell a comprehensive story, but rather to evoke the day and its aftermath. And the exhibit focused on victims, survivors, and rescuers, rather than on the terrorists, relegating the terrorists to only brief mentions. And the museum crafted the exhibition as a place for memory, arguing that every one of us, everyone who came to that museum, was part of that story, bearing witness to history, that we all had memories. That we should share. So we took care to share voice and authority with not only the victims, survivors, and rescuers, but all of our visitors. In other words, after all of that debate, the museum engaged with the public on very personal levels. And that was very much a departure for us. We usually just interpret the past. with millions of visitors coming through every year. The events of September 11 were still fresh in many people's minds, and the exhibition was designed to evoke strong emotions and memories. The museum, however, did not surrender all ground. The museum avoided perhaps the defining element of a memorial. There was no list of victims. Instead, the museum simply dedicated the exhibit to the victims, the survivors, and the rescuers. Over its 10-month run at the museum, the exhibition became a pilgrimage site, with over a million visitors quietly filing through it as though on holy ground. While the public response exceeded all expectations, the exhibition did not evoke the one response we were concerned about. It did not become a memorial site. No one left objects or tokens. No one responded to it as they did to the spontaneous memorials or to official memorials. But perhaps that was because the museum incorporated into the exhibition opportunities for visitors to express themselves through the written word, the spoken word, and drawing, as well as to express themselves later through the exhibition website. At the end of the exhibition, visitors were asked, "How did you witness history on September 11? How has your life been affected by that day?" They could respond, as you can see, by either writing or drawing on cards provided the museum, or speaking over a phone set up in the space. While there were some expressions of anger toward not only the terrorists but Muslims in general, few expressed political sentiments beyond pride and patriotism, with numerous repetitions of "God bless America" or "United we stand." What runs through nearly all the comments are expressions of sadness, loss, and fear. If you can read that one, it says simply, "I'm not a fearful person, I am now." Altogether, over 20,000 of the cards have been digitized, and 425 voicemails have been preserved, all made available through the website I mentioned earlier, the September 11 Digital Archive. Selected cards were also posted in the exhibition, much as expressions of grief and condolence were shared at the spontaneous shrines. The overall experience of the exhibition was communal, with visitors grouped quietly around tables, sharing with each other their responses. In sum, the exhibition clearly served a memorial function, and the museum indeed engaged in memorialization despite our original intentions. The World Trade Center Visitor Center, the Tribute Center, has since established a similar area, collecting tens of thousands of visitor response cards in 47 languages from individuals from 110 countries. Conclusion. Americans responded to September 11 with grief for themselves and anger toward the terrorists and those who supported them. Indeed, it provided an all-too-rare sense of connectedness. Unfortunately, racial profiling and discrimination, uncritical patriotism, and war were also consequences of that day. September 11 posed challenges for museums as they attempted to do their work in a new and difficult context. But that context did not really include political criticism or censorship, and collecting was never politicized. While the actions or positions of American museums after September 11 may be viewed from outside the country as political, within the United States they were not. The only differences or disagreements had to do with museums' collecting jurisdictions, not politics, not the politics of what we collected. And even those tensions were eased. We created a 30-museum collecting consortium in September of 2001. The use of September 11 collections in future exhibitions, however, will almost certainly be contested. As the shock of September 11 fades into memory as we approach the 10th anniversary, museums face the challenge of coming to grips with why terrorists attacked the United States and what that says about the nation's role in a globalized society. And we know, and I can be happy to talk about this, that an honest assessment is certain to be unsettling for the public, and we know it will be unacceptable for the victims' families. The challenge not only for the Museum of American History, but all museums regarding September 11, was to steer a course that responded to the needs and concerns of the public without compromising our fundamental commitment to making meaning of the past. But then that is always our goal. What was different was the level of emotion that constituted the context for and shaped our work. We faced new challenges to our sense of our work and ourselves as professionals, and it was critical that we respond to those challenges thoughtfully and positively, embracing the opportunity to help our visitors understand these tragic events and contributing to the nation's healing. Thank you.
September 11 was obviously an extraordinarily serious event in world history, and what we've just had is a very, very unique insight into how an institution handled the responsibilities that came with documenting that event, and something about some of the personal challenges that clearly the staff faced as well. We have a little bit of time for questions, so if you have one, I would be...
And I'll also be around for a few days if people want to talk elsewhere.
You can actually make a time to talk to Jim separately, because he is here for a couple of days, or if staff from other institutions would like him to come visit them, I'm sure that can be arranged as well. So come and talk to myself or Matt or Jim at the conclusion of this talk. Now, if you have a question, I'm going to ask you to use the microphone because we're recording this event for podcasting on our website. I can see Matt Trinker's hand going up here and Mike Pickering. I might go up the back.
Thanks, Jim. Mike Pickering, National Museum. You raised the... You identified that some of the objects being collected may be contaminated by human
yes.
tissue, which is obviously a concern to the 9/11 Memorial Museum as well,
mm-hmm.
Probably to any museum doing any collecting
yeah.
at all. How has the Museum of American History addressed that issue?
How did we deal? Well, there were several things that were done. First of all, objects were generally bagged as soon as they were collected, so that until we knew what we were dealing with. One of the issues was, of course, that conservators tended to want to clean, or they wanted to do things to them. We wanted to do testing, but we didn't want a wipe sample to show on the object if we were exhibiting it. So we did some testing. We sent a number of the objects to a laboratory where they could do lofting tests, because the issue was not just what's on it that you would touch, but what would loft off the object into the air. Then you get into issues of contaminating the exhibition space and putting visitors at risk. So the whole series of ways that we tested both the substance on the objects and what would loft from them. We also tried, one of the things we wanted to do, though, was to have an object that people could touch, a piece of steel from the World Trade Center. And what we ended up doing was basically covering the object with wax. It wasn't apparent if you were looking at it, but it certainly would protect visitors from any of the contamination. The issue was that conservators wanted to deal with contaminants and the curators wanted to preserve the contaminants. So it was always a negotiated process back and forth. Some of the objects remain contained. This flag, which was pulled from the rubble of the World Trade Center, is actually encapsulated because it is so contaminated. It's not just that it's fragile, but that it's so contaminated. So it's encapsulated, and a number of things were encapsulated. It really was a negotiation and trying to see what to do. But this is an area where you don't want the objects to be clean. You want the objects to show to be what they were. And that was a difficult deal to work out. But they are, the ones that are dangerous are encapsulated or contained. Some testing, but we really didn't clean anything.
Okay. Has there been any expression of concern by families about the collection and display of objects that may be contaminated by?
You mean by any concern by victims' families? Or,
yes, victim,
okay.
Yeah.
No. They actually, the one place where the issue of remains, human remains, dust of human remains came into play, the National Museum of the American Indian, which is a Smithsonian museum, has a facility on Lower Broadway that was became very dusty. The Native American Museum actually had a ceremony before they cleaned anything, and about human, you know, they wanted to deal with it as the human remains rather than as dust. So they really went through this in a more sort of religious way than the other museums did. Of course, we weren't located there, so we weren't running into that same to that same issue.
Kate Cowie from the Museum of Australian Democracy at Old Parliament House. I noted during the exhibition you had quiet spaces and a large number of visitors. I wondered what strategies you had in place for your front-of-house staff to deal with distressed people and people who needed help getting through the experience.
Well, two different things that we did. First of all, we closed the museum before the opening and opened it up only to victims, families and friends, survivors and rescuers. So we had a full day so that they could come privately rather than going through the exhibition publicly. So we thought that would be the group that would be most distressed by the exhibit. So we did that. We actually had grief counselors in the exhibition throughout that day to deal with people, and they did indeed have to deal with people. You know, I recall seeing a man sort of walk through one area, turn around, and just sort of put his head against the wall and sob. So we had that sort of and then we sent someone over to help him get through it and, you know, and sit down and all that. We didn't have that dramatic a response within the exhibition from the public. We were concerned, I will say on the front end, that the atmosphere might not be appropriate, but we never had an instance in which anyone went through that exhibit that was not quiet and respectful. So it was really a very sort of religious experience in a strange way, not the sort of thing. I mean, we have millions of visitors and they ping pong around and they're noisy and all that. People stood in line all the way through the exhibition. We had rows of chairs for people to sit in. The front of house was dealing with making certain that there were to replenish the Kleenex boxes and take out the trash, because it's not something we normally do, but that was something that had to be done in that regard. We also had staffing in the Tell Us Your Story section so that people could there would be someone there to, you know, take their cards to, you know, thank them, to be engaged with them in that regard. And, you know, we had occasions where we had sort of VIPs. The First Lady came and sat down at a table and filled out her own card. So that sort of thing was all part of it. But apart from the families, we had less of that sort of emotional response. People were simply quiet. They might be crying, but not the sobbing and really dramatic. We had training for the front of house staff in how to deal with it. I think it was the Red Cross provided training in grief counseling so that they would know how to respond if indeed we had someone. So we always had staff in and around the exhibition.
I wanted to ask whether or not you wanted to, or if you did, collect any objects that related to the other stories that you can't tell yet. So specifically about the terrorists. Their families, or, you know, even other kinds of interpretations that people might be ready to hear 10 years on and probably certainly 50 years on.
Okay, we did collect a number of things that have never been exhibited. some that probably won't be exhibited next year. We thought 10 years out there would be some sort of, you know, distance. There is, I think, more distance on the part of the public. There's absolutely no distance on the part of the victims' families and friends. They've made it absolutely clear. The World Trade Center, the National Memorial and Museum, is really under attack for having a corridor that deals with the terrorists themselves. The families are adamantly opposed to it and consider it inappropriate. So that's sort of part of it. One of the interesting things about the Smithsonian and the federal government, the U.S. government, is that through a court case, it has been deemed that the Smithsonian, that transferring things, objects, to the Smithsonian does not break the chain of evidence. So the FBI can transfer things to us without breaking the chain of evidence, which is something that they prefer in case there is a litigation or, you know, criminal prosecution at some point. So there is collecting undergoing. We had curators who sat down with the evidence files at the FBI and sort of, you know, I'll take that one and this one and that one. We haven't actually brought that material into the museum, but are trying to sort of close that up right now. But we've already identified what we would collect from the FBI evidence files. We have a few things in the collection as it is. I think we have an Islamic prayer book that was found at one of the crash sites. So there are very few things like that. But it's really interesting dealing with this and dealing with the terrorist side of it. Now, one thing just that I didn't talk about is we had the exhibit. At the same time, we created a series of programs called Crossroads, in which we took on the topics that we didn't think we could do in an exhibit in that particular medium. So the Crossroads discussions dealt with things like racial profiling. You know, we had a lunchtime discussion in which we invited the public in, and we had, you know, people out on the metro handing out flyers to get people to come to the museum, and we talked about racial profiling. We had colleagues from the Japanese American National Museum talking about parallels to the ways that Japanese Americans were treated after World War II. So we had a session on, I moderated a session between two very different points of view about the conflict between the West and the Muslim world, and what we know or think we know, or what's behind the hostility that September 11 clearly demonstrated. So we had a discussion on gender and the different roles. Part of what we were trying to do is help people understand how complicated it all was, both in terms of our actions and in terms of the Muslim world and where terrorism fits into that world and all of that. So, So we were dealing with some of this. But within the exhibit, we at one point had a line in an exhibition in one of the labels that said 1,000 whatever people died at World Trade Center. Families insisted that we change that number because we had included the terrorists as dying. And they wanted to say 1,000 so many victims and then the number of terrorists. They did not want the victims and the terrorists rolled into one number. So, yeah. Just for a couple of seconds, is next year. And next year is going to be a huge problem. It's the 10th anniversary. We're trying to sort out what we're going to do. One of the things that we will almost certainly do is have a symposium that will be more about memory and history. And what we want to do for the symposium that we will do in the days before September 11 is bring together people with different points of view on different moments in our history and all of that. So we'll have a session on the politics of memory. We'll have a session on memory and museums. and one on the architecture of memory that will really focus on monuments and memorials, and both people on both sides and criticism and all that, but trying to move it from beyond this one event to look at Oklahoma City and Columbine and the Vietnam Wall and all that sort of thing. That's a program, a symposium. What are we going to do on the exhibit side? We're not doing an exhibit, in part because we don't know where we'd get the money to do an exhibit that would be big enough to make people happy. Small scale's not going to be good. It has to be bigger. So what we're going to do is spend the week running up to September 11 with, we often do what we call objects out of storage, in which we bring collections out. We're going to have a gallery space, a rather large gallery space, that will be, there'll be some images and perhaps a few objects in a case. But what we're going to have is have curators out with objects on tables, talking to the visitors about how they were collected, what they mean, but having a more personal or intimate relation with our visitors than an exhibition. We're hoping it'll work. It remains to be seen. So,
well, I think we'll definitely have to try and get some Australians to that symposium. But in the meantime, thank you very much for coming to us. Can you please join me in thanking Jim Gardner?
The National Museum of Australia in Canberra explores what it means to be Australian through our permanent galleries, exhibitions, public programs, and the National Historical Collection. Find out more about the museum at nma.gov.au or download more audio programs from nma.gov.au/audio.